It is an hour on your wallet. Money issues front and center here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So if you work in retail, in hospitality, restaurant, and other service industries, you know full well you bore the brunt of last year's mass layoffs in the pandemic. But now workers' wages are rising at the fastest pace in years, suggesting businesses that struggle to hire may be paying more to attract employees. At this point in the recovery, are you living paycheck to paycheck? Are you caught up on all your bills? How are you managing? What's your strategy? It's 800-642-1234. Lynette Kalfani-Cox is known as the Money Coach. She's the author of more than a dozen books on personal finance, including Zero Debt and the Millionaire Kids Club series. Lynette, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be back.
Well, I'm thinking about the feelings that came up, the impulses, the first time I re-entered, you know, a box store and didn't schedule a pickup or just buy the items I needed online. And first time I re-entered a restaurant for a meal. What should we think about in terms of our finances as the economy reopens and we start to resume some normal patterns and buying habits?
Well, certainly it's going to be an adjustment on a lot of us as the economy starts to reopen. There is not only, of course, the financial practicalities involved in terms of new spending habits, perhaps, new ways to spend, being in person, et cetera. But I do think that the mental and emotional toll that has really been quite severe over the past 14, 15 months needs to be taken into account because it will unequivocally impact people in a fiscal manner. So part of what we're seeing is a lot of pent-up demand. So we know that the pandemic hit various groups disproportionately. And so we might want to think about it in terms of three different buckets of Americans, right? There are those who are struggling, who perhaps had job losses, who had reduced incomes or had their hours cut, that kind of thing. And they're still feeling the pinch of things financially. Then there are the group of people who are saying, oh, thank God I didn't lose a job or my hours are pretty stable. We've been able to kind of keep our heads above water and stay afloat even during the pandemic. And then the third group of folks are those who are kind of like, woohoo, you know, there's a party going on economically in America. The stock market is up. My housing prices or property that I might own is on the rise. I'm gaining in equity. My business continues to thrive and to do well. So as we think about sort of habits and what people are going to be doing going forward economically, some of the choices that people are going to be making are going to be driven by, of course, their own financial circumstances, where they fit into one of those three buckets, but also from a mental kind of standpoint, how ready emotionally people are to re-engage in the world. And for those who have held back, certainly those who are in that second bucket, just kind of keeping things afloat, or those who are doing quite well or pretty okay, they have a lot of spending choices and options. And so the real concern there is to kind of not go overboard. Yes, we're all going to be able to travel, you know, in the not too distant future if we so choose, because, you know, the vaccines are rolling out and things of that nature. But to some extent, all of the savings and the almost hoarding level of people preserving cash, curious about whether that will preserve itself going forward.
Yeah, because it's hard to fight that feeling of, you know, I've been through stuff this year, right? It's been hard. I could buy this thing for myself, maybe that vacation that the family needs just this once. And so as you look at that mental toll and connecting with the fiscal aspect of it, that will be really telling and interesting.
It really will be. And you said something, Kate, that is one of the, you know, foremost potentially dangerous words in personal finance. Just this
just
one time.
Just this one time.
Because we can convince ourselves of anything. We can constantly say, oh, you know what? It's that YOLO kind of feeling. You only live once. Mm-hmm. And oh, I work hard for a living. I deserve it. And no question about it. I tell my coaching clients this. You do deserve to reap the benefits of your hard work and to, you know, not have to feel like, oh, you're in a financial straitjacket. However, you also deserve to feel a minimum of financial stress that is self-imposed or self-induced. And so you mentioned travel and vacations, for example. My family is one of those. So our daughter, who's 15, just received her second vaccine. And in July, she'll be going to camp for 3 weeks. Mm. And so now my husband Earl and I, we're like, where are we going? What are we going to be doing? And, you know, certainly, obviously, we took no vacation in 2020 because of the pandemic. But even in 2019, because we moved from New Jersey to the state of Texas, and we moved June 23rd. So we took no summer vacation because we were like, let's get settled into the greater Houston region and let's get Alexis ready for school in the fall. So we didn't travel in 2019. So really 2018 was kind of like the last, you know, real summer vacation for us. And so, yeah, there's pent up emotional, you know, drive.
I'm feeling like this is overdue for you.
Yes, it certainly is.
I can feel it emanating.
But I'm imagining all of the, you know, multiply me, you know, we've got 300 million people in this country, multiply what we're feeling, you know, times, again, hundreds of millions of people who are also, whatever their own family, personal circumstances might be, whether it's, oh, I haven't been out into a restaurant. And I can tell you that I've not dined in at a restaurant yet, even though I'm fully vaccinated, fully immunized. Mm. Sort of waiting for the rest of the country, for everybody else to keep it going here. However, I have started to do things, you know, more and more things. I have been into stores, obviously, and shopping and in retail and in supermarkets, whereas during the pandemic, I was like, deliver everything, you know, groceries delivery, Amazon delivery, et cetera. And then last month, for the first time, I got on a plane and I traveled from our area, again, the Houston region, just to Dallas, just a 45-minute.
That's like up and down, yeah.
Yeah, it was a very quick one. But again, I'm imagining now, as I'm starting to look at flights and looking at the CDC advisory for, you know, countries on level 1 and 2 and 3 and 4, and, you know, where we might take a little jaunt for my husband and I am thinking about, you know, the amount of pent-up demand that is going to be unleashed in various areas, travel, retail, certainly everything in the entertainment sector and hospitality and dining and so forth and so on. So part of the challenge, what I'm saying to us all, is that we really have to be careful in this moment, because those who, you know, fared decently, you have to fight the urge to overspend, to whip out plastic, and to wind up charging, you know, too much, and to accrue unnecessary credit card debt, which can in turn impact your credit score, you know, which can in turn impact potentially your insurance rates and things of that nature, which can also, from a credit standpoint, impact your ability to get a job or a promotion. You know, you might be traveling and you forgot to put that bill on auto pay, or perhaps you thought your spouse was going to pay the bill and they thought you were going to pay the bill, whatever, and there was a missed payment. Well, a single missed payment can lower your FICO credit score by 50 to 100 points. Mm. And again, those who are potentially in the job market, either looking for a new employment opportunities, or potentially trying to get a raise or a promotion on the job, we know that about 57% of all employers According to SHRM, the Society for Human Resources Management, about 57% of all employers do employment-based credit screening, meaning that they check your credit reports before determining who to hire and who to promote. So again, during this reopening period, we want to manage credit wisely and we want to protect our credit rating at all costs.
We have personal finance expert Lynette Calfani-Cox fielding a variety of money questions this hour. Have you refinanced your mortgage or applied for a new apartment in these times? What have you discovered? What have you done to build your credit? How do you protect your good or excellent credit score? And what is your financial position? What bucket are you in at this point in the pandemic recovery? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking about personal finance and tackling debt on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. After the May jobs report came out, President Biden said the rescue payments mattered for families, quoting data from the Census Bureau.
More than 40% fewer families struggle to afford food, rent, utilities, car payments, student loans, and health care expenses. Small businesses and restaurants were getting killed. Now we're delivering loans and support they need to reopen and to stay open.
What did the stimulus checks do for your family? Have you struggled to keep up with mortgage or credit card payments? How are things looking now? Does stress about money keep you up at night? Let's talk it through. 800-642-1234. We have personal finance expert and author of Zero Debt, Lynette Calfani-Cox, is with us for the hour. Lynette, you were talking about these three buckets, and clearly there is no one single story of how the pandemic has affected a person's financial outlook. But how do you like to take stock of where you're at financially? What do you do and ask yourself, you know, as you see your next financial moves?
I think one great way for people to take stock of where they are is to ask themselves sort of two basic questions. One is, am I able to pay all of my bills every single month without problem? And two is, what kind of cash cushion or emergency reserve do I have? So the answer to the first question, if the answer to the first question is yes, I'm able to pay, you know, my bills, you know, pretty much with no problem, you're likely in bucket number two or number three. If the answer is no, you're probably in that first group of folks who have either had job loss or job reduction, or the salary that you're earning is low and is not enough to be able to cover all your bills. And then for those who are looking at shoring up their financial defenses, which is what all of us should be doing in the wake of the pandemic, one of the biggest lessons was that we all need to have a bigger and a more healthy cash cushion to deal with emergencies and the unexpected, because we never know how long an emergency might last. So if the second question is about, you know, surrounding how much of a cash cushion or an emergency reserve you have, you want to think about some general benchmarks. Again, this is just a guideline, not a hard and fast rule, but generally speaking, you'd like to see people have about 3 months worth of expenses set aside in an emergency cash cushion. Now, this is a goal, and I get it that most people have nowhere near this. So let's say your bills each month are $3,000 total, you know, for your housing, your utilities, your car notes, student loans, whatever, your food, et cetera. And I just pulled $3,000 out of the hat. Then ideally, you know, in an ideal world, you'd have about $9,000 set aside in an emergency fund that you don't touch in case the unexpected happens. And what is the unexpected? You know, I call them the dreaded D's: downsizing, divorce, a death in the family of the main breadwinner, disability or disease. Because anytime one of these five dreaded D's happens to you, it can throw your finances out of whack And again, for a lot of people, unfortunately, it forces them into debt or it makes them make poor financial choices. So, you know, even if you don't have that 3 months worth of expenses already set aside, and again, I get it that most people don't, you might say, listen, I have $500 or $1,000 set aside right now. And if 3 months worth of expenses do indeed total, say, $9,000, you need to start saying, I'm going to work towards it. So you might be able to save maybe $200 a month. And if it's $200 a month this month and $200 a month next month and then the next, well, look, 5 months into that, you've got $1,000 saved. So if you already had $1,000 and 5 months later, okay, there's a second thousand. And then five more months, you've got another thousand. Now you've got $3,000 or 1 month worth of your emergency cash cushion. Honestly, that's tremendous for most people. So, you know, the idea is to take it into bite-sized chunks. Don't feel overwhelmed and don't sort of, you know, throw your hands up in the air and go, oh my God, I'm never going to be able to reach this target. So I'm just going to do nothing. You don't want to take the ostrich approach, as I call it, which is basically sticking your head in the sand and kind of ignoring financial problems that really can be solved if you take baby steps towards overcoming those obstacles.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Lynette Kalfani Cox, who is the money coach, and we're spending the hour on savings, debt, emergency funds, loans, building credit worthiness, taking your questions as well at 800-642-1234. Lynette, I suppose this is a practical matter here, but where do you put your emergency savings?
So that's a great question. You want to keep it in a liquid account. That just means something that's easily accessible and not a problem for you to get to without penalty or fees. So this is not money you want to put in the stock market. This is money that you want to have in either something like a high yield savings account, and high yield is, you know, put, let's quotes around that, given, you know, the low interest rate environment that
we're
like
in. What, like 0.1? You know?
High is relative, no, admittedly. But something like a savings account or a quote-unquote high-yield savings account, or even like a money market account, again, if which retains it's the same, you know, $1 value. It's not going to go down or anything like that. So those are the types of accounts. People can look certainly at a variety of financial institutions in order to get the best return on whatever cash they might have, right? So we're in this era of fintech, financial technology, where not only do you have your major banks, you have local institutions and banks right in your own community, you have credit unions, you have online financial institutions, which typically pay, frankly, a lot higher interest rates on your savings. So you want to do comparison shopping around that and just, you know, kind of look around and see who might be offering, you know, 0.5% as opposed to 0.1%.
Yeah. So. And I shopped around and I found that a credit cards financial bank, I wouldn't say which one, but, you know, a credit cards financial bank really did offer online a better option and linking it up to easily to a checking account, I'm able to make those transfers more easily. Because I think if there are any barriers, I may not do it, right? Like making it very smooth is, to me, one of the things that's going to help me do it, you know, on a regular basis.
Right. But, you know, here's the tricky part, Kate. And I've seen this in my, you know, 18 years as a money coach. On the one hand, we do want to create more seamless, frictionless possibilities for consumers to be able to access their financial information and data, their financial accounts, and to be able to maneuver with ease and convenience. But on the other hand, in some areas, particularly when it comes to emergency savings, we actually want to make it a little harder. So Sometimes I'll tell my coaching clients that, you know, we're in a, again, in a new era where mostly every financial institution has some, you know, online presence and access to account information online, et cetera. But, you know, I certainly remember in the not too distant past where, you know, if it was a credit union or a smaller community bank, there might be, you know, one or two branches. And it was a little bit hard to access your funds. You had to drive to get there. but in some ways, I'm telling you, this actually works for a lot of people. To not have it accessible, it helps them to not touch the money unless it's really and truly an emergency. So I would tell people, you know, have it in an account or in a place that's not particularly close to your house or to your job, so you won't just like rush by the ATM on your way home, you know, that kind of thing.
We have personal finance expert and author of Zero Debt, Lynette Kalfani Cox, with us on all types of money matters. We'll pick this up with her after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It is You and Your Money, How to Handle Debt, this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the debt help organization, debt.org, the average credit card holder has more than two cards. The average household credit card debt is over $5,300. What type of debt do you carry? Is it home, car, student loans, credit cards, a mix of all of those? How are you managing your debt in these times? Join in 800-642-1234. Lynette Kalfani Cox is known as the Money Coach. She's the author of Zero Debt and other personal finance books, and she's with us for the hour. So, Lynette, about a couple of months ago, I got a call from my bank at about 6:30 at night. I'm folding laundry, and I pick up the call. It's a local number, a lender on the phone, and I said, you know, is everything okay with my accounts at the bank? And by the way, there was, you know, ample verification. I was talking to my bank, but the banker said, look, I'm here at work. I just ran some numbers. Your home loan came up. You should really refinance. There are no costs to do it, and you'll save over $20,000 over the life of your loan. So, Lynette, I'm like, this is a no-brainer, right? So I'm wondering, you know, what are you seeing in the area of refinancing?
Well, that's a great question, because we have seen initially kind of a refinancing boom in the 2019 and 20 period. And then it kind of cooled off a little bit in recent months because the Fed has kept rates so low that it has been advantageous for most folks to refinance and get, you know, pretty much like a 3%, you know, again, depending on your credit score and all of that and how much equity you have in the property. But certainly anybody who has, you know, good to excellent credit and who has 20% or more equity in their home, meaning that their loan balance is about 80% or lower of what the actual market value of the property is, then yes, I do think it's a great opportunity to refinance if you haven't already. But I'll tell you, there's a couple of things that could potentially be glitches to look out for in this era, because we know, of course, that the housing market has definitely been hot, you know, in many cities. So a lot of people are looking to either buy or sell or refinance. But many people who want to refinance or sell can often encounter something that's a major problem in the housing industry, and that's lowball appraisals. And so that's when an appraiser basically gives a written opinion about your house's value that's actually far less than it's really worth. So clearly a low appraisal can cause a sale. If you were going to sell your property, it can cause that sale to fall through, or can hurt your chance to refinance. And so this is an issue for a lot of homeowners all across the country, but especially, I should note, for African-American property owners. So there have been all these different, you know, sort of anecdotal reports and research studies that show how essentially Black homes are valued a lot less. Or when I say Black homes, I mean homes that are owned by Black homeowners, and in particular in predominantly African-American communities, or even when Black homeowners are in majority white communities, their homes are valued less. And the Brookings Institute put a price on this, and they said it was about $48,000 is the sort of devaluation of Black homeowner properties.
Wow, that's a lot.
I know I'm African American, and I've personally experienced getting a very lowball appraisal. In one case, I challenged it. We had a second appraiser come back, and the valuation came back more than $100,000 higher. Wow. So regardless, you know, you don't have to be African American to take advantage of these tips. But I would say that if you want to avoid a lowball appraisal and you're about to refinance or to sell a property, a couple things you can do. One is you should get a CMA from a realtor. A CMA is a competitive market analysis. The realtor will pretty much just run comps and say, okay, based on homes in your area with the same number of bedrooms and bathrooms and the same type of square footage, et cetera, this is the sort of going rate for the properties, right? You can also use digital real estate tools, whether that's, you know, Open Door or Realtor or Zillow, all those kinds of things that will give you some assessments about market value. What I found to be effective is to not be afraid to give your appraiser, when they come into your house, that actual data on relevant comps, because then they know that you're an informed consumer, you know, you're a property owner who's done a little homework here. And if they come up with some crazy number that's really like out of the pale, you're gonna say, here, I've got local comps. A realtor gave me this. I've used these tools. So you're kind of, you know, putting them a little bit softly on notice that, yeah, I know what the going value is. And you can also be proactive when the appraiser comes in terms of highlighting the upgrades or improvements, any extras that your house might have that kind of sets it apart. So those are some general ideas. If you're going to refinance and you want that appraisal to come back strong, or if you're going to sell, I might add quickly for Black property owners, there's three or four things that I would suggest. Sadly, you know, one option is to omit your race on your mortgage application. Now, banks and credit unions and financial institutions, they certainly ask the question, but you don't have to disclose your race. Honestly, I do. I happen to own my house and I own seven other rental investment properties. And when I get a mortgage, I actually do include my race on my application. I do it because I'm actually trying to give the lender that I'm working with credit, because the government tabulates these figures, and it does track which lenders are lending to people of color, et cetera. So I want the bank, the credit union, the institution that I'm dealing with to quote unquote get credit for doing business with me as an African-American property owner. But again, in some instances, honestly, I think it might be more to some Black property owners' advantage to just omit their race on their mortgage application. If you have an appraiser coming in, another thing I suggest for African-American property owners is make your property kind of as race neutral as possible to avoid any kind of potential bias. Yes, that means taking down family photos and things on the wall that indicate that this is a Black family. I know this might seem like, some people might be like, I am absolutely not going to do this. But again, I'll tell you, I did it. I had, you know, when I had a crazy comp one time, I did it. And the second time I came back with that appraisal that was more than $100,000 higher. In the last two areas, you know, some people I know have considered or have used, frankly, a stand-in, if you will. They had a third party, typically a white friend or a neighbor or a colleague, to actually be present in the home when the appraiser came. And again, I know these are sensitive issues, and we don't, you know, like to talk about this, of course, but we're all in this country going through a racial reckoning about the myriad of ways in which there are inequalities throughout our society. Certainly in the wake of the pandemic, we saw healthcare disparities with the killing of George Floyd last year and on, and so many other African-Americans who have been killed either at the hands of police or else, you know, in other forms. We're talking about social justice and criminal justice inequities. And of course, we're also looking at financial inequities. And the appraisal industry actually knows that this is a challenge. Their national trade groups and associations, they're on a diversity push right now. They recognize there's a problem. They've admitted that there's a lot of bias and subjectivity in, you know, where there's sort of gray areas in the reports. And they're starting to try to make amends and address this topic. But again, in the meantime, these are some strategies that all homeowners can take. And certainly if you're a Black property owner and you need to refinance or sell your house, then these are some steps I'd recommend as well in terms of defending your home value and avoiding a lowball appraisal.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with financial news journalist and author Lynette Calfani Cox as she is helping us to save money, look at moves we can do to get out from under debt. You can join in. Are you looking for a loan or a mortgage? What have you done to build your credit? How do you maintain a decent score? Do you have your home on the market? What are you thinking about? 800-642-1234. Lynette, in the process of refinancing, what are some hidden fees that people should look out for? What should you look for in the fine print?
Well, certainly on the refinancing front, many lenders, if you're an existing customer, one of the appeals of going with an existing lender or creditor is that they'll typically try to market and promote the refinance as a sort of no cost deal. In other words, they'll say there's no points attached to it. Many times they won't have an application fee. Sometimes they won't even have an appraisal fee. They might use Fannie Mae system desktop underwriter, or they might do what's called a drive-by appraisal. Mm-hmm. They're not literally driving by. They're literally using digital data tools to assess home value. And again, because we've seen a great amount of price appreciation, they can make some educated guesses about the value of your property. Now, if you've renovated your kitchen and your bathrooms, or if you added a room, et cetera, they're not going to know all of that. So you would have to disclose it to them or let them see it and that kind of thing. But generally speaking, you, of course, want to have the least amount of fees as possible, because anytime you add, a cost to a mortgage overall, that's, you know, taking away a little bit of the equity, the built-in value of the home. So you might have to have a title policy issued again. And you might ask for what's called a reissue rate on the title fees. Title costs can sometimes be expensive. And title is to just sort of verify kind of the chain of things and to say who's on the deed. And, you know, if it was a sale that's being affected, you want to be able to pass clean title as a seller to the buyer. Or if you're refinancing, again, they'll still check title to make sure there are no liens or encumbrances on the property. But again, if you've been, you say, I've been living here the past 3 years, 2 years, 18 years, whatever it's been, I'm the only homeowner who's been here, my family. And here I had a title policy before. Some lenders will say, depending on how long ago the initial title policy, when you first bought it, they'll say you might be eligible for a so-called reissue rate. And again, that can save you some money as well.
We're looking closely at the push-pull of savings and debt with Lynette Kalfani-Cox, who's known as the Money Coach. Are you working on boosting your savings or erasing debt? Is it some of both? How do you prioritize what you should sock away and what you should put into lowering your overall debt? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have the money coach, Lynette Kalfani-Cox, talking to us about debt and managing money. Some good news out of the New York Federal Reserve in recent days. Americans are making remarkable progress in paying down credit cards. According to the Fed's data, credit card balances fell by a whopping $49 billion in the first quarter of this year. Still time to talk about credit, your financial outlook, 800-642-1234. Lynette is with us for about 10 more minutes. Katie is with us from Eau Claire. Hi, Katie. What is your question?
Good morning. So one is a comment and one is a question. My husband and I have worked over the past 4 years to pay down about $55,000 worth of debt, and that's student loans and ridiculous credit cards and just really bad choices throughout the years. I've been really proud of the progress that we've made. And we've gotten to the point where now, whenever we have a larger expense, we take it out of savings, and then we make a payment plan to ourselves to pay that money back. So it depends on the amount that we have to pay back, but we give ourselves somewhere between like 6 months to 18 months. And so now we're making larger purchases, but we're paying ourselves back for it without having to pay any interest or put down any cards. And it's a really glorious feeling.
Wow.
But
yeah.
Now we have to buy a new vehicle. And we're looking for, of course, a vehicle that right now is inflated in price up to about 17% higher than what we would traditionally want to pay for it. And so I'm wondering, because we'll be financing the vehicle, what is better, going through a dealership and looking at their financing or going through a bank and trying to get financing from them?
So first, Katie, congrats on paying off that $55,000 worth of debt. I mean, that's amazing. Kudos to you and your husband, and for creating a plan to kind of stick with it and to, you know, make sure that you're saving and you know, paying yourself really to make sure that you stay on financial track. On the auto loan front, generally speaking, I actually do think it's a good idea to walk into a car dealer armed with your financing. Then you have an option. If they can offer you something better than what you've already been able to obtain, great, you take it. But essentially, when you go in armed with a check, really, because you've already shopped online, you've seen what lenders are offering in terms of financing for either a new or a used vehicle, depending on what you're in the market for, then you already sort of know, like, this is the interest rate, this is the loan amount that I qualify for. So you're not under pressure and you're not under the gun. Now, if the dealer has something that can actually beat what you've been offered, of course you take that better offer. But I would go in with my own financing, because it also gives you leverage when you're, you know, talking about pricing and everything. You wait, you hold that information back, by the way, until the very, very end when you start talking about how you're going to pay for the car.
Katie, does that sound like a plan?
Yeah, that actually makes way more sense than the way that I was going to do it. So thank you.
Thank you. Good luck. Paul now is joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead. Yeah.
All right, hi. Is there ways to increase your credit even slowly without lending?
Hi, Paul. Thanks for the question. And yes, there are ways to increase your credit score without borrowing or incurring more debt. Traditionally, those are the main ways that you would actually establish, boost, or, you know, maintain a credit score, by taking on a loan of some kind, a credit card debt, student loan debt, mortgage, auto financing, etc. But you can still boost your credit score in a couple different ways. One is through piggybacking. For example, you can have your yourself added as an authorized user on someone else's credit card account, a spouse with good credit, a parent, someone who knows and trusts you. They don't even have to give you the credit card, for example. We've done this with our adult children. They're older now. They're 23 and 21 years old. My 23-year-old has a credit score above 800 because I added her as a authorized user on one of my credit cards. In addition to piggybacking, folks who are renters can have their rental payment information added to their credit reports. You can't do it personally. You have to go through third-party companies, and they do charge a fee. It's not overly expensive. It's something like 15 or 20 bucks, roughly. But they'll add your rental payment history to your credit reports so that that non-traditional credit data will also be taken into account, and your positive payment history as a renter will count to help boost your credit scores. In other areas as well, if you have certain non-traditional accounts, utility payments and so forth, there are some of the credit bureaus on Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion offer you the ability, I'm thinking of Experian in particular, offer you the ability to add things like utility payments to your credit reports. And in turn, that helps you to generate or increase your credit score. So all of those are strategies that you can do to boost your credit score without taking on any more debt.
Oh, it's kind of like building out your own credit history there. I'm wondering, though, at what point does your debt begin to affect your FICO credit score?
Well, your debt always impacts your credit score, no matter how much or how little you have.
Okay.
So folks need to understand, like, here's the formula. There's five main components that go into your FICO credit score. Factor number one, 35% of your FICO score is based on your payment track record. In other words, how well are you paying your bills on time? That's rule number one always. You never want to miss any payments. You don't want to be 30 days or more late on a payment. Number two, 30% is based on the amount of debt that you're carrying, and specifically the amount of credit card debt. That's the predominant factor in terms of the debt that the credit scoring system is looking at. 15% of your credit score is the third factor, and that's based on the length of your credit history. And then the final two factors are each 10%. 10% is attributable to the mix of credit or the type of credit that's shown in your credit files, like mortgage loans, installment loans, like student loans or car notes, and then credit card debt. And then the final 10% is related to inquiries or new applications for credit. Bottom line here, you only want to apply for credit when you really and truly need it, because each inquiry that is generated on your credit report for a new credit application stays on your credit report for 2 years, and wow, it counts against you for the purpose of your FICO score for 1 year.
Lynette, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Lynette Kalfani-Cox is known as the Money Coach, author of more than a dozen books on personal finance, including Zero Debt, The Ultimate Guide to Financial Freedom. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.